I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In the last 20 years, downtown Kansas City has transformed, and a lot of people credit that to former Mayor Kay Barnes. Her work led to the Power and Light District and the Sprint Center. But while the skyline has continued to change, development for many neighborhoods east of Troost has been slow. Today we ask Mayor Barnes about her legacy and where she sees work in town that still needs doing. Then people know about the militancy of the Black Panthers, but their social and political outreach receives less attention. Hear how the organization improved communities right here in Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Life moves on for former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes. These days, the first woman mayor in city history is Senior Director for University Engagement at Park University. She's also fresh off the honor of having the Grand Ballroom at the Kansas City Convention Center named after her. Meantime, the transformation of downtown Kansas City that began under her watch continues with a skyline that seems to change by the month. Mayor Kay Barnes joins us now, and welcome back. Congratulations on the Bartle Hall honor.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you, Steve.
What do you make of downtown Kansas City these days?
It's exciting to see all that has happened and is still occurring. The ancillary mushrooming effect of some of the larger projects has been exciting to see, whether we're talking about the River Market or Crossroads or moving east toward 18th and Vine. There's so much vitality. I'm delighted to see it all happen.
Did you anticipate the renaissance that we've seen that has gone so far beyond what you originally put in place?
I think I could honestly say I've been somewhat surprised by the magnitude of what has happened. To see so many people congregate in the greater downtown area, the streetcar has certainly been a terrific addition. So the growth, the vitality seems to continue to expand even beyond those initial boundaries.
You know, downtowns have become happening places all over the country. When you first began to make your move on downtown, were you seeing that around the country, or was that still sort of before that sort of movement began to happen?
Certainly, it was obvious in some cities, and having been very involved with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, I had exposure to some of those success stories. I was particularly aware of what had already been happening in Denver. So when we had the opportunity to hire Wayne Cawthon as our city manager, with his experience in managing major project development there, I knew that we were going to be on the right path.
What would you like to see in downtown Kansas City that's not there today?
Certainly, more affordable housing, I think, is important. We've had a good mix in the past. I think we need some additional work on that now. Certainly, there are areas and specific buildings that warrant redevelopment that are still there, whether we look in the East Crossroads area or elsewhere. So I think that is one part of the equation that needs to be amped up some at this point.
As you look back on it now, when you made the move to hire Cordish Development from Kentucky that had a track record of redeveloping downtowns across the country, ultimately, how big of a gamble were you taking?
I don't think we were taking a gamble with the Cordish Company in terms of their reputation and what they had already demonstrated. They had never had an unsuccessful project, and they had, at that time, never sold a project. Mm-hmm. They were reluctant at first to consider Kansas City as a location, so we needed to do some encouraging of their interest, and that really didn't take long. Once they came to Kansas City and they saw the magnitude of what needed to be done, then they began to react with enthusiasm.
But you had to sell them on the idea, at least
yes,
originally.
Yes, very much so. And the same is true with AEG related to the arena. The initial answer
the
we got
center.
From both was,
yeah.
No, we're not interested. And yet we kept pushing. And when I say we, I mean people like Andy Udras, who headed up our Economic Development Corporation, Herb Kahn, with his close relationship with the leadership at AEG. So it ended up working.
Has the relationship with Cordish gone as you had hoped it would?
I'm not privy to the last several years in terms of any detail.
Right.
I do know that they're continuing investment in Kansas City with the additional housing, the new wonderful buildings that they have constructed, one light, two light, plans now for three light. That says to me that their investment and their enthusiasm about Kansas City continues.
Were one light, two light, and three light on the drawing board originally?
There was considerable discussion about that potential from the very beginning. Obviously, everyone knew it would have to come in stages. So I've been delighted to see that initial vision unfold.
You know, the city still subsidizes the Power and Light District. Is that a disappointment for you,
given
how much energy and vitality is down there?
It's not a disappointment because that investment, that ongoing investment on the part of the city has reaped enormous rewards. As we look at the tax revenue, for example, that's been generated as a result of all of those ancillary developments, I'm very comfortable with that investment.
Former Mayor Kay Barnes is my guest. What was the bigger achievement for you, Mayor, developing the Power and Light District or building the Sprint Center?
I don't have a favorite in that sense because what I feel best about is the combination of large projects that we were all able to move forward at the same time. We really didn't have the luxury of doing one project and then 2 years later doing another one. So the reality of being able to move several projects forward, housing, the Sprint Center, Power and Light District, even the early stages of the Performing Arts Center, H&R Block, moving all of those forward in a similar period of time is really what I feel best about.
I was going to say, is that the legacy? Is that what you hope people will remember you for decades down the road?
I don't spend a lot of time wondering about how people are going to think of me. When you're mayor, you get over that quickly because you know a lot of what people are thinking is not necessarily positive.
Yeah.
So I'm just hopeful that whatever legacy there is one that enables people to feel good about themselves, feel good about their community, and be willing to participate in the future of Kansas City.
Let's take a step back just for a moment, Mayor, and take a broader view here. How do you size up the state of Kansas City these days?
I think the state of Kansas City is basically positive. Certainly the biggest problem we seem to be encountering is with crime, and that has to continue to be addressed. It certainly was an issue, a concern when I was mayor. The answer is a complicated one. We need a holistic approach. Everybody, I think, now understands that. To implement that is very challenging. I have
confidence. Is it challenging because it's complicated or because it's costly or both?
It is costly to some extent. I think it will require not just money. It's not throwing money at it. It is garnering a large enough segment from different parts of the community to work unceasingly together, whether that's partly related to education, partly to developing better relationships within the community and the police department. The list goes on and on. Poverty issues. So we all say what I'm saying, and there's no way to deal with it more effectively than people continuing to make the commitment to find answers.
I was going to say, when you listen to city leaders these days talk about this, you know, a lot of the boxes get checked. There's these innovative programs, there's social workers, there's, you know, renewed emphasis on the Kansas City, Missouri School District, there's, you know, different ways of policing. And yet, in the wake of this recent spate we're going through of all kinds of shootings, you just don't get a sense that city leaders have anything new to offer because they've tried a lot of new things. And from what we can tell here, nothing really seems to be catching.
I think that what has already been attempted needs to continue. I think there probably needs to be a more concerted effort by larger numbers of people in different sectors of the community, perhaps to come together in some sort of way that hasn't occurred at least recently. I don't think we can ignore the availability of guns as part of the issue. It certainly is one that I see being a big part of the problem.
However,
it's not the only issue.
That's an issue that has to be addressed by lawmakers in Jeff City. Republicans control the state capitol. They're not going to change gun laws here.
At least in the short term.
At least in the short term, yeah. But ultimately, all this is pretty confounding.
Yes, it is. It is a problem. It is a major problem, and it's one that I'm sure will be a major topic of conversation in the upcoming city elections.
Now, in retrospect, should the city have been investing more in making improvements to the east side, you know, through jobs, through pre-K education, through greater police presence, in a bid to prevent a crime rate like this?
In retrospect, yes, I think that is accurate, although I would only qualify it by saying there has been a lot of effort over the last 20, 30 years to make more investments on the east side. I agree, though, that not enough has been done. When I went out of office, and up until about a year ago, I was doing some consulting work with leadership in the northeast part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience reinforced for me how large our city is, what a diverse population we have.
Right.
And from a positive perspective, what the potential is in many of those neighborhoods, whether it's the Northeast or as we move further south in our city, of what can be done and what should be done.
You wonder if politically the next mayor of Kansas City, the candidates who run, could get elected on a platform that says, you know, we've done the downtown, we've focused heavily on the plaza, now we're going to focus on the east side of our community and making this city whole. Would that work politically? Could you get elected on that platform?
I don't think it's so much a political issue as how realistic that is. And I mean by that, that even the redevelopment of our greater downtown has increased dramatically the number of jobs available for people who live in less advantaged neighborhoods. So that's not to say that more shouldn't be occurring literally within the east side boundaries, whatever those boundaries
right.
might be perceived to be. We need, I think, to continue to be open to all kinds of development and redevelopment opportunities throughout the city, as long as there are genuine efforts made to engage people in, again, less advantageous situations to find work, to find education, to find what they need to build their lives.
You know, for so long, a lot of, you know, experts, so-called experts would say, all we need are jobs. We need jobs. Well, now the unemployment rate is, you know, very low, and jobs doesn't seem to be an issue. They're available to people if they want them, and yet we're still seeing these problems.
We're still seeing problems, for sure. I still think, though, that jobs have to be available for people. We'd have a lot more problems if that were not the case.
Former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes is my guest. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. We have a question from Al here. Mayor, if you'd slip on your headphones, we're going to take it right now. Al from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. Wow. Great and complicated show. But my question is going back a bit. Did we make any kind of a Herculean effort to approach the local wealth, the local gentry, to invest in their city? Only about 18% of the investment in the development of downtown actually came from local money. And where there is no local investment, how can there be ownership and commitment? So I've always had a problem with this, and I'm wondering why, Mayor Barnes, you didn't kind of reach out to the local money aggressively before you went to these other markets, which take money out of our town.
How about local investments in Kansas City over the last number of years?
Certainly, there were people representing that population that you just described who were very involved in the development and redevelopment efforts, for example, in the greater downtown, through the Civic Council, which is made up of the CEOs of the top 100 corporations. Right. They funded a considerable amount of prep work that was done, supporting the state legislation that we had to have. We also recognized that if you think specifically about the Arena and the Power and Light District, those are extraordinarily complicated and sophisticated, not only building approaches, but maintenance in terms of operations, bookings at the arena, and the development and redevelopment of particular venues within the Power and Light District. In my opinion, those required people who had national expertise. And I think the success of the Power and Light District and the success of the Sprint Center are to a great extent due to that outside involvement. Mm-hmm. And in fact, using the Sprint Center as an example, over $10 million in, quote, profits from the bookings at the Sprint Center have gone back into the city coffers and, as a result, available to our citizens for local projects.
I'm wondering, what did you learn about what it took to be a good mayor that maybe you didn't know when you became mayor in 1999?
I remember Emanuel Cleaver telling me, you know, it's a steep learning curve when you're mayor. And obviously, that was what I experienced. It was an amazing experience. And I think one of the most important things I learned was how necessary it was to be a good listener, mm-hmm. to know that at times you're going to have to take a stand, you're going to have to be the leader. And yet those experiences of hearing out other people and representatives of different organizations in the community was absolutely vital. So I think I've always been a good listener, but I had a lot of practice when I was mayor.
How ready was this city to have a woman lead it?
I think the city was very ready. We certainly had Carol Marinovich as an example at about the same time.
Right.
We had other women in the different counties in the region who were moving into positions of leadership. We had a woman representing a portion of the region in Congress. So certainly there was a climate at that time for women to be in elected office.
Did you get the kind of flack that suggested anyone tell you, you can't be a good mayor, you're a woman? Did you get that?
I never got that comment to my face. I knew that there were comments behind my back about, well, she might be okay as mayor in some ways, but she's not going to be able to do much with economic development. when I was on a panel with Carol Marinovich and Peggy Dunn from Leawood and Karen Messerly from Lee Summit, we would all laugh about that because, as it has turned out, all four of us put an enormous amount of effort into economic development and in many cases were successful.
But for some people, that was seen as a male bastion.
Exactly.
Women can't lure businesses to a major city. That's interesting. Do you remember your first day as mayor? Were you particularly nervous? Do you recall it?
I remember very vaguely my first day as mayor. Obviously, there was the installation and an event that evening. So I think it was primarily being caught up in all of the fol-de-rol and celebration part.
Yeah,
I was very fortunate to have terrific people around me. I had 15 people on my staff, almost all of whom were with me for 8 years.
Wow.
So after the first, second, third year, they were really acclimated to their roles and did a terrific job, made it so much easier for me to focus on only what I needed to focus on.
How did you wind up at Park University?
I was approached by the leadership at Park in 2006 to consider coming on board at Park when I went out of office as mayor, which I subsequently did, and have actually been with Park now for coming on 12 years. So I did a lot of teaching in the Graduate School for Public Affairs those first several years. I taught a course on leadership, and I've gradually segued the last few years into more of a community liaison role, which I really love because Park is a great university to represent.
How did you like teaching, being in the classroom?
Well, my background is as a teacher, so I've done a lot of that work professionally over the decades, so very comfortable in that role.
You're now the university's Senior Director for University Engagement. That sounds really serious. What does it mean?
It basically means taking every opportunity to create linkages between the university and the community. I have some involvement, for example, with the Greater Kansas City Chamber, as does Park University. So as a representative of Park, I'm involved increasingly there. The Downtown Council, certainly taking every opportunity, both within the Park family and out in the region, to speak about Park, to make presentations. I love the variety of what I'm doing, and I'm happy to represent Park. As I said, it's a great, amazing, actually, university.
You know, Mayor, you haven't shied away from remaining involved in politics. You endorsed Tom Nierman in the race for that congressional seat in Johnson and Wyandotte counties this month. How do you decide when to engage and when to hold off?
Each situation is different, obviously. If I am particularly struck by someone's seeming interest in public service, experience, a really solid track record, good representation as far as people around that individual. So those are some of the things that are of interest to me. Tom Nierman is a terrific human being. And was a great candidate. So I was happy to support him.
You'd like to see Jason Kander in the mayor's office before too long.
I've known Jason for a really long time, for someone who is young as he is. And I think he's a terrific guy. I admire what he has already accomplished. So when he approached me about supporting him for mayor, and indicated that he and Jolie Justice had reached an agreement because I think she was certainly a very strong candidate for mayor, as are some of the others.
Right.
I found it easy because of my past relationship with Jason to fall into support behind his candidacy for mayor.
That's former Mayor Kay Barnes. Mayor, it's always good to have you here. Thanks for taking some time. Thanks for giving us your views on so many things. I sure appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the legacy of the Black Panthers in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we met with a remarkable Kansas City teen poet. You'll want to hear her work and what she says about poetry giving her and other young people a voice. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday, KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund highlights a Kansas swimmer who's in the international spotlight. We'll also see if Topeka-born Jayhawk Gary Woodland held onto his first-round lead in this weekend's PGA Championship. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the Black Panther Party was founded in Oakland, California in 1966 with the purpose of defending African Americans from police brutality and violent racism. Chapters then formed in several U.S. cities, including Kansas City in 1969, less than a year after deadly rioting devastated East Side neighborhoods. The new documentary, Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers, examines the history of the Kansas City organization and its founder, Pete O'Neill, who's now exiled in Tanzania. The film looks beyond the militancy associated with the party and focuses on the services the Black Panthers provided to the African American community. Those services included free breakfast programs, clothing drives, health screenings, and political and educational literacy. With us now are two men who helped make this film. They are Lyle Gibson. He's the producer of this documentary. Lyle, welcome.
Thank you.
Jermaine Thomas was its director. Jermaine, nice to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Who were the Black Panthers, Jermaine?
Well, the Black Panthers, they were more than just a militant organization. As you stated earlier, they provided social awareness programs. They provided, they saw a need for sickle cell testing, and they provided breakfast programs for the community.
But, you know, today, Lyle, I'm guessing here that most people, including many white folks, don't have a great sense of who they were. They don't have a great reputation.
Right. And I think it speaks to even our social climate today with not truly understanding the types of things individuals face in this society. So back in the 1950s and 60s, when the Black Panther Party was founded, they were speaking to the injustices of police brutality in the community. And sadly, today in 2018, we still have those problems.
You know, maybe the problem is a Black Panther, that's a scary animal.
It is. But here's something that's very unique. Actually, Huey P. Newton had to get
the founder
of the party, yeah, had to get permission from a group of individuals in Alabama who were trying to register African Americans to vote. And in part due to some illiteracy rates, people figured that if they recognized the symbol of a Black Panther, they would know to vote for that particular party. So Huey P. Newton had to ask for permission to use the Black Panther for his new organization.
So he sought it out.
Yes.
Why didn't he pick a different animal?
Well, I think it was...
Huey's not around anymore to ask, I don't think.
It was just the nature of the panther itself, kind of being that type of animal, that predatory animal, and they just decided to move forward with that.
Jermaine, just to be clear, were the Panthers here in Kansas City ever violent?
No, sir. They did arm themselves for protection, but their main goal was, like I stated earlier, their main goal was uplifting the social community.
Because even today, when we talk about the Panthers, Pete O'Neill just did an interview with KCUR's Laura Ziegler a few months ago. And even in that interview, Pete O'Neill says, again, the founder of the Panthers in Kansas City, says there's still a place for violence if it's required.
Well, you have to be able to defend yourself. I think that particular statement a lot of times is taken out of context, whether it's from fear or not understanding. But if you look at the social climate of the times, they were being attacked. And you have to remember, Huey studied law. So they didn't just go grab guns and say, hey, let's just kill cops or nothing like that. He told them, look, you can stand so far and observe what the cops is doing, you know, but if you have to defend yourself, then that's what you do.
But even Pete O'Neill, even today, Lyle, says that, you know, he never fully embraced Martin Luther King's nonviolent emphasis.
Right. And you have to put that within context, because many people, if you peel back the layers of all of the social things that were going on in the 1950s and 1960s, you still had the fundamental belief in self-defense. You had the right to protect yourself. And even before the Panthers, there were numerous African Americans throughout different parts of the South that believed in defending yourself. Even within my own family, my great-grandfather believed in self-defense.
So you're talking about defense as opposed to offense,
right,
as a place where where the Panthers landed here.
Very true, because if you look at the civil rights struggle, if you look at it within the context of a war, the casualties were really one-sided. And that was the people that were trying to fight for justice and equality. They were the ones being killed. So it's not an offensive war. It's a defensive. And so some people believe that you could defend yourself.
Jermaine, so to what extent, then, are you trying to go back and flip the Panthers' image with this new documentary? And why are you doing it now? So many years have passed.
Well, I actually had a chance to, I actually went to culinary school with Pete O'Neill's daughter.
Ah.
And so when I graduated, I originally studied culinary arts, and then I end up going to college and studying film. So I met Charlotte O'Neill when they was having the 50th anniversary a few years ago. And
the
so 50th she allowed
anniversary,
me,
the founding of the party here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so she allowed me to shout at her and take video and pictures. Me and my partner at the time was Cicero Owens Jr. Shout out to Cicero. But he was doing photography and I was doing video. And I was learning so much about, I mean, I've heard about the Black Panthers, but that side of community service, which a lot of people really don't see. So it just slipped off my tongue. I was like, Charlotte, people need to know this. You know, they need to know that you guys did more than just violent things that people think you did, but they need to know about the community services that you were providing. And so,
because in that sense, the Panthers really were ahead of their times, weren't they?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think, where is it located? There's still a Panther clinic in operation. I think it's in North Carolina.
North Carolina, I believe. Yes.
Yeah, but there's still a Panther clinic in operation, and they provided sickle cell anemia testing and all different other health services to the community. So when I spoke with Charlotte, she was like, well, let's do it. So I sat down and I got with, because I had produced a film with Lyle, Black Tie, White Tie, which is my first had a directing. So I sat down with Lyle and I said, Lyle, I just, since he's a historian also, I said, hey, I need your help on this. And Lyle was like, hey, man, let's do it. So we got together and we started writing, and that's how that came about.
I want to be real clear on a point here, though, before it gets lost. I mean, you're focusing on the Panthers, their social outreach, the programs they made. But again, you referred to violence a minute ago, Jermaine. Were the Panthers violent in Kansas City?
The Panthers, there were, I would say, skirmishes, like after with the riots of 68.
Because they came around after the riots.
Right.
Right after
the
riots.
Actually, they were formed before the riots, according to Andre Weatherby Rawls and Charlotte Hill O'Neill. They were formed in 67, but really didn't start becoming active until 68. But with the riots that happened in April of 68.
After King was assassinated.
His assassination. There were just the riots and the skirmishes that took place. But when we look at the Kansas City chapter, there was no offensive acts of violence, I should say, between the Panthers and the police. But I do want to stress that the Panthers in their founding, whether Kansas City or the National Chapter, is deeply rooted in the historical aspects of Booker T. Washington and self-help. One of the things that I think gets lost when we look at civil rights in a broader scope is that African Americans were really trying to be treated as equal, but also wanted to make sure that they could do things for themselves. Mm. But somehow that got lost in the transition of things, in the struggle. And then with the narrative, especially when we look at what was going on in California, what was going on with in Chicago when Fred Hampton was assassinated, yes, there were some violent acts nationally, but it was really broader than that. And if we peel back the layers, we actually can take a look at, okay, what led to the violence? A lot of it was dealing with the police brutality, plants within the organization, not only local law enforcement plants in the Black Panther Party, but also federal FBI plants were in the Black Panther Party.
Because there was so much nervousness as to what the Panthers were up to.
Right. And you have to look at J. Edgar Hoover, former director of the FBI. You know, that we can't allow a black messiah to rise in this nation, or the, you know, the greatest threat that this nation faces is the Black Panther Party or Martin Luther King. And we have to ask ourselves, why would Martin Luther King be a threat? Why would the rise of a national black leader be a threat? Why would African Americans who advocate, you know, the Second Amendment and self-defense, why would that be a threat? And I think that's really the million-dollar question.
So if I'm hearing you right, then it sounds like the Panthers at the time were on this knife's edge. They had reasons to stand up for themselves and to do what was necessary. At the same time, they were trying to adhere to a self-help kind of mantra to improve the plight of African Americans throughout Kansas City and throughout the other cities around the country where they had chapters. Am I seeing that right?
Right.
That's
true. Their
slogan,
there's a bifurcated focus here in a sense.
Right. Yes. And their slogan, "All Power to the People," didn't just mean African Americans. It means white power to white people, red power to red people, black power to black people, all power to the people. And they had chapters in seven foreign countries as well.
So what was the impetus then for Pete O'Neill and others to start a Panther chapter in Kansas City back in the late 60s?
Well, they saw a lot of the, in their communities, they saw, like Lyle said, they saw a need for self-help. And when they saw, when they looked and seen the chapter started out in Oakland, they thought, as Charlotte put it, they thought, hey, we need to do the same thing here. You know, we need to implement these programs to help African Americans in the community. You know, they had reading programs, they had social justice programs. So implementing that system here was their way of saying, hey, you know, this is our way of self-help.
And this was really good stuff. It sounds like there are programs that nobody even today would have any issue with.
That's very true. And even when we look at Charlotte and Pete's program today, they still are carrying on the legacy in Tanzania. They've adopted and taken in, yes, so many children, providing them with education, after-school programs, music programs. And so this whole aspect of community building continues today in East Africa. And, you know, we have to wonder once again, what is it within the context of our American society when African Americans want to try to help themselves, stand for themselves, somehow that's kind of put down? You know, that's the question.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about a new documentary on the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers. That documentary is titled Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. And Lyle and Jermaine will be presenting the film at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the Downtown Central Library at 14 West 10th Street. Maybe we should pause just for a moment, Jermaine, and explain to our listeners, why is Pete O'Neill today in Tanzania in Africa? Why is he not in Kansas City?
Well, he was exiled.
Left, right?
He had to leave because he was going to, I'll let Lyle answer that. That's more of his history. But from what I understand is he left because he was going to be arrested on some trumped up charges. So he left, him and his wife left, and they stayed in Tanzania.
It was gun possession charges,
yes,
right?
Yes. It was supposed, wasn't it, that he's crossed,
yes,
the line?
But crossing, yes, crossing the state lines. But however, there was statements that the weapon was not even in the car that he was traveling in. But as a result, he and his wife Charlotte had to flee the country. And they went over to North Africa first and stayed for a little while, and then eventually going over into Tanzania.
Yeah.
And because of that, you know, he's still on, I'm not sure where on the FBI watch list, but if he comes back to United States territories, he will be arrested.
And we should point out that Congressman Emanuel Cleaver has tried, I think, repeatedly for a pardon for Pete O'Neill. Maybe thought at one point in the Obama administration he had a shot at it, but it never occurred.
That's correct. That's correct. And I believe they are distantly related, if I make no mistake, also. Yeah.
So tell us a little more about the programs the Panthers organized and started here, because, again, getting some of these things off the ground struck me as kind of a Herculean effort here.
Besides the food program, they had political education classes. And the challenge they ran into that is a lot of the people that was enrolling in these classes couldn't read. And so they took their time and started reading classes so they can get these people to the next level and understanding what's going on at that time politically, that they could have a say so in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So,
because that notion was still at that time lost on a lot of people.
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to note, if I can add, that members of the community also, once they realized what the local chapter here was doing, they also participated in ways that they could. So grocery store merchants were donating food, people were donating clothes, people were donating supplies. So what happened, we really started to see a community effort in support of the initiatives that the local chapter was involved in.
So why didn't it continue? What happened?
To be honest, I really believe at the national level, this posed a threat. And when the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO, or the counterintelligence program, you had spies and plants in different organizations, civil rights organizations.
Do you know that for a fact? I mean, have records been released that document some of this?
Yes, and if memory serves me correctly, it was a FBI field office in the state of Pennsylvania where I want to say some college students actually gained access to those records that exposed COINTELPRO. And many of those records, because of the Freedom of Information Act, are available online. Now, a lot of the records will be redacted, but you can see that, you know, the FBI was heavily engaged in surveillance in all of the civil rights movement.
So did the FBI then sort of break down the Panthers and stop it from continuing? Is that what the sense is?
I would say in part, yes, along with local police agencies. And then, of course, you know, we do have individuals that were part of the Panther Party that did turn, maybe go a wrong direction with regards to the law, and did their own things. But I think it was just kind of a concerted effort by multiple agencies to really bring groups like the Panthers down.
So, Jermaine, ultimately, do you believe that the Panthers, their community service work has been far overshadowed by other aspects of the Panthers that remain controversial?
Oh, most definitely, because when I remember when we first screened this film, I had a lot of people come to me and tell me that, well, when I think of the Black Panthers, all I think about is fighting the police and, you know, violence. And so they just totally missed the point.
And that's what your film is trying to rectify. Yeah. How were the Panthers regarded by the Black community itself back in those days?
You know, that's a good question. Like I mentioned before, there were many business owners, once they really felt comfortable with the mission of what the Panthers were trying to do for the community, they participated. They donated items, donated food. I've even asked individuals who were young adults in the 60s. Many of the ones that I've talked to said, yeah, I remember the Panthers. I really didn't associate with them much, but I remember some of the things that they tried to do. And so I think what was happening back then, even with regards to likes of a Dr. Martin Luther King, sometimes if you talk to folks who were either teenagers or young adults back then, oh, I heard of that person, but, you know, I really wasn't a follower? Because, you know, even like today, a lot of folks are just engaged or involved in their everyday lives. They're not oblivious to what's going on, but they may not have been involved.
To what extent would the east side of this community be different today if the Panthers had remained in existence?
Oh, that's a weighted question. That's almost saying, like, had Malcolm X and Martin Luther King lived. You know, I really don't know, but there's something deep inside that says maybe a little bit better.
You know, Pete O'Neill's wife, Charlotte Hill O'Neill, you've mentioned her today, is listed as a producer on the documentary. How were you able to bring her onto the project?
Oh, they didn't. Well, like I said, when she came and she did the 50th anniversary, and I saw that this aspect wasn't really highlighted as far as historical wise, I had no problem getting her on. But the thing was, the thing also was, she's a musician too, a very accomplished musician. So even she did a musical piece for the film. And so I thought, and that it's called, I think it's called African Spirits. And so she, besides being a producer, she also worked on the musical side.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Lyle Gibson, Jermaine Thomas will present Legacy, Spirit of the Black Panthers. It happens 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the Downtown Central Library. Thank you both very much for coming in and talking about your project. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, sir.
On Monday, Mayor Sly James will be in to defend a tax scheme to fund pre-K in Kansas City, Missouri. Tune in for that. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scherer, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all. And you are up to date.